This is Chick Flick Fix. I'm Julia Scott.
And I'm AJ Knox.
We watch chick flicks and rom-coms and decide if they need fixing. Can we make them better or can we make them weird? This week we're talking about But I'm a Cheerleader from 1999. It's directed by Jamie Babbitt and written by Babbitt and Brian Peterson. And it stars Natasha Lyonne, Clea DuVall, Kathy Moriarty, and RuPaul Charles. Babbitt has worked on Girls and Gilmore Girls, which I don't know why I find that funny. Russian Doll, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, and she directed the first episode of the A League of Their Own series that we talked about in that episode.
The one that's coming out on Amazon? That's cool. So wait, right? She did Russian Doll. What did she do with Russian Doll?
She directed a couple of episodes.
Oh my God. I fell in love with that show. That show like hooked me. It ended and I was like, I just want to stay up all night and talk about this show.
And then rewatch it.
It's so good.
We went to New York like a couple of months after that show and like did our own little Russian Doll walking tour.
Oh, I love it. That's awesome.
So we like went to the park and like took a picture of me by that sort of gatepost.
Yep.
And it felt so ridiculous, but it was so much fun. I know, to be like, hey, that's this is that shop and here, don't fall in the grate. You know, it's.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
The idea for this came partly because Babbitt's mother runs or ran a halfway house called New Directions for young people with drug and alcohol problems.
No way.
And she had wanted to make like a comedy about rehab and the 12-step program. And then she read an article about a guy who'd come back from, quote unquote, reparative therapy camp, hating himself. And she decided to combine the two ideas, sort of.
That's okay. Like, I can totally see that because there is a lot of, like, 12-step type of stuff. I have no idea how accurate this film's version of, like, reparative therapy is. I'm sure, I know it's totally satirized and goofy. And
I feel also like we should just say, like, gay conversion, pray the gay away camp, because all these, like, flowery sort of talking around the issue. I'm not accusing either of us. I said it first with a very sarcastic tone of voice. But also in 2005... the New York Musical Theater Festival featured a musical stage adaptation of But I'm a Cheerleader.
Of course. This would be a great stage play, I will say that.
It really, really would. Had you seen this before?
I had not. Well, so this is the thing. I had not seen it. Like, I know I have not seen this movie, but there were certain, like, shots and visuals that I was like, I have seen this. So I must have, like, absorbed it in, you know, by osmosis somewhere along the way from like, cause a lot of the production design felt recognizable, but I definitely hadn't watched the whole movie or seen it.
I think though that this might be a movie that you could feel sort of deja vu-y about just because it's so hyper stylized.
Yeah.
Like
that's true.
It's sort of like a toned down John Waters or like a certain flavor of music video.
Yeah.
Like Spike Jones.
90s music video is like all over this movie.
Yeah. So it could even be that, I think. And like just the shifting through colors and things.
Yeah. And it does. And it has like some Edward Scissorhands vibes for sure. So yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's because one of the supporting actors is Mink Stole. The mom who obviously is a John Waters staple, which I think maybe like confuses the mind even more.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, like, I had no idea that this was a queer film. Like, I thought this was, like, a rom-com-y, like, Romy and Michelle, Clueless-style movie. And, like, very instantly it was like, oh, this is not what this movie is. Which I really appreciated, because I was like, I don't know if I want to watch, like, a teen comedy about high school. Right.
Well, you're welcome. In this, that weird sort of confluence of once you think about something, you see it everywhere. I was listening to a podcast recently where they talked about this movie and both the people involved were like, oh yeah, no, I watched it when I was like 12 because I thought it was just like a cheerleader movie and it was not. Because I saw this when it came out or like when it was fairly new at least. I rented it from Blockbuster and watched it in San Diego. And, you know, I think we watched it as like a group in the Gay Straight Alliance at my house.
I was part of the GSA, so maybe I did see it.
Or you were asleep.
Yeah.
Or you had something else to do that weekend, and then we all talked about it. But I remember, because this is like a funny thing. I was through high school, I wouldn't say I was like a closeted bisexual. I was just like in that weird state of like, well, everyone thinks girls are pretty. And because I like felt accepted for whatever my sexuality was from my parents, and because I didn't feel any problem about it, uh-huh. I didn't feel like this is something that I have to hide, or I was just like, no, nah, not
like
really.
And then,
yeah, but then like slowly I started to realize, and we had friends who were like, call me in 10 years, you're going to be an out lesbian, which I was like, part of me was like, that's actually not cool to say to someone,
yeah,
because they might not be, but then, you know, we were all 16, 17, but then like slowly over the years, but you know, so this movie was both like formative and important, and like it kind of like as a 17-year-old just like felt important that it existed. Mm-hmm. So like both a little bit important for me, but I think also just like something inside me appreciates that this movie exists and like is available at Blockbuster. And I think it had an R rating, so I don't know. Or maybe it was NC-17 and that's why I could rent it. Or I had just turned 18. I don't know. But
well, I just read that it had an R rating, or it had an NC-17 rating, and then they took 2 seconds of over the clothes hand stuff.
Action.
Out. 2 seconds. They took 2 seconds out and it got an R. And then apparently Babbitt was interviewed for a documentary called The Film Is Not Yet Rated, where she talked about like how the MPAA is more strict and
about queer storylines.
About queer,
yeah.
Or particularly like female queer.
Because that's, you know, morally depraved and will ruin the youth.
Yeah.
We should do like a special episode about just moral codes and cinema through the ages.
I have some fun stuff I've researched about the Hays Code.
Anyway. I was about to start talking about how I feel about this movie, but that's not what we're doing yet. What is this movie about, AJ?
Dear Lord, we thank you for the abundance that you have provided. Please bless this food that we are about to eat. And Lord, please help us to obey the roles in life you set for us. Megan, we love you. And lately we've become concerned about certain behaviors. We're afraid you're being influenced by that.
Honey, we think you're a...
Mm-hmm. All right. So, yeah, it starts off and we meet Natasha Lyonne's character, Megan. She's a cheerleader and she's dating, you know, the quarterback. Or I don't think they ever say what he is, but she's like the cheerleader. Who
football
dates
star.
Yeah. And right off the bat, it starts off like very typical, like, hey, we're seeing cheerleader stuff and we're in a high school, you know, cheerleader football situation. And then they're in his car and they're making out, and it is like the funniest makeout scene because
it really, really is. I think I posted a snapshot of it from my phone onto my Instagram stories.
It's so good because she's just like eyes wide open, just kind of like scanning around the car, like so disinterested.
I need to look at something. I'm so bored.
Yeah, so bored, so disinterested. And it's just like, it is just straight. I don't think I've seen a makeout scene that's like that funny in a long time. So right off the bat, you're like, oh, she's not into this for whatever reason. You don't really catch on quite yet unless you're smarter than me. Because I was still like, I don't know what this movie is.
Which, can I just say, and again, this is not in any way anything about you, but it's interesting because the opening scenes are very male gazey unless you know what it's about. Because it's like close-ups of like boobs. Like it's slow motion close-ups of cheerleading practice and very specific.
Yeah, and like,
and what's funny is that I could see not just you, but anyone just being like, yeah, whatever, it's a teen movie. It doesn't register that those scenes mean something. Even if it's just like, this is going to be more American Pie style. It's just like, that's how we film cheerleaders. Lol.
You know? I think there was like one shot where like a cheerleader's like jumping and like, it's like, hard on the crotch, like mm-hmm. hard shot on the crotch. And I was like, oh, and I remember going like, that seems a little aggressive for a teen cheerleading movie. unless they're going for like an American Pie vibe, you know, which mm-hmm. there's an element of American Pie style humor to this, but definitely not as straight white male-y as that movie is. But yeah, so we're introduced to her. She's making out with her boyfriend, and not enjoying it. You know, we meet her family who are pretty buttoned up and conservative seeming. And very quickly in the film, her boyfriend, and it seems like the whole school is kind of in on this, like her team, her friends, her parents, stage an intervention for her where, because she is a vegetarian and listens to Melissa Etheridge, they believe that she is gay.
And already here you start to get, because again, I don't know if you thought about it, but everyone is wearing shades of brown.
Yes, everyone's like very drab.
Which at first, when they're just at her house, you don't think about as much. But when you see a high school, like, corridor.
Yeah, and it's
and
just like,
everyone is in shades of brown. And that's where you start to sort of go,
Yeah. That's like the movie's, like, first little dabble into the hyper-stylization. And so, yeah. So she's kind of forced into this intervention, and her boyfriend's like, well, you don't even like making out with me. So her boyfriend knows, I thought he was going to be like dumb jock who didn't like, couldn't read signs, but he gets it. But she is sent to True Directions, which is, yes, a Pray the Gay Way camp. And they have their 5-step program, but they are introduced to the, I guess the recruiter is RuPaul out of drag.
Who also like, cause he's at the intervention. So it feels like one of those, you know, also just like camp for troubled teens. Like they show up in the middle of the night and take you away. And like, they've already packed her bag for her.
Yeah. And so they send her away to this camp. And, when they pull up, it is this like dollhouse with, you know, bright neon pink and baby blue and like bright green lawn and these like fake flowers. It's all very
and
like,
giant pink picket fences.
Yeah, giant pink fences. And it's just like, it is so, and I didn't quite catch on. I was like, that's a lot of pink for like a Pray the Gay Away camp. And then I was like, oh, this movie isn't just about sexuality, it's about gender roles. So it's like the pinks and the blues become like the confirmation of your gender identity within the movie. And so she shows up at True Directions. We meet the founder who's, you know, a little bit of Dolores Umbridge, Mary Brown, and her son. Of course, he's named Rock. And he is, according to her, according to his mom, he's straight. He's not straight.
Straight as a $2 bill.
Yeah, clearly Rock Hudson, you know, homage in there.
Except that he does in no way try to play straight.
No, not at all.
Rock Hudson style. He is extremely like camp.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Yeah. She joins into this. Yeah, I hate calling it a camp, but this group of you know, teenagers and young adults who are have been sent there.
You can call it a brainwashing program.
Brainwashing program. What I kind of love about, once you meet all the other people who are being forced to participate in this awful program, is like very few of them are playing heterosexual. Like there is a camp quality to the performances, which is like right off the bat you're like, this shit doesn't work. Which I really appreciated. But yeah, we meet a group of women and men and I think what the movie is kind of getting at with some couple non-binary characters. They're all there trying to be cure the gay away.
But also, again, like this funny idea that the reason that you're gay, because there's only gay here, it's very binary, pun intended, is just that like you haven't understood your gender roles and the beauty of the gender binary, which is like a really interesting take, and one you do see in some ways, but not as clearly expressed. So what's funny is that even though there are a few things, like you can get put in a literal tiny little doghouse, or there's the electric shock therapy, most of it is not as like, hilariously, not as harsh as actual like gay conversion camps. Because there's this weird underlying thing that if you just learn to change diapers clean and like, so
yeah.
then you won't be interested in women anymore. And I'm like, put women together doing womanly things. Lady, I don't know. And I mean, obviously
that's
the movie,
what the movie
the
does.
Movie plays with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it's interesting that it's not about like, hey, we're going to zap you every time you have a gay thought, or we're going to make you look at, pictures. Like it's as if like you just need to fall into the structure.
Right.
Because like you're saying also that when you said none of them are playing straight, because the whole point here is that like they've been found out. There are a couple yeah. of, people who would be, you know, straight passing is just such a weird straight term in general, but like who aren't as stereotypically gay, and even that, you know, becomes part of it. But like the idea is that as long as you can fake it through these things, fixing cars, mm-hmm. Making dinner, it kind of doesn't even matter who you actually like, you know, even though she's been trying to, like, she has not been admitting this to herself.
Yeah.
And that's part of the storyline. I just find it fascinating that like the structure of this camp is more of like, if you can just build the structure up around, which is more like the 12-step programs exactly. of like, just you have to build up a structure where drinking or whatever it is isn't the thing you turn to. Where yeah. if you feel a little gay, just fix a car / embroider and
turn it off
like a light switch. Just, you know, wait for it to pass.
Yeah. And the steps are funny. I jotted them down. So there's, because it is like very much a 12-step style program. So there's, and the movie is kind of broken down by like, as the steps are happening, they're like following the steps, and that follows the plot of the movie. So there's step one, admit your homosexuality. Step two is rediscover your gender identity, which is interesting that it like, that's, as you were saying, like that's part of the cure in this film, quote unquote cure. And then step three, find the root of your homosexuality usually based in trauma. It's like what this film applies, like find the
traumatic. And I think kind of like classic psychology, preferably based in your mother if yeah. you can.
Yeah. And then demystifying the opposite sex, and then finally simulated heterosexual intercourse is the final step, which is of course like that also, it reminds me of the Monty Python and the Meaning of Life sex ed mm-hmm. class, where it's like, we're just going to come up here and have heterosexual sex in front of you to teach you what this is. So everyone's at this camp. They're starting to go through this. We start to meet all the other campers, including Rufio from Hook, which was like, oh, you made other movies. I honestly, like, he kind of faded off from films after Hook so quickly that, like, in my mind, it's just like he did Hook, and then it was like, I don't want to do this anymore.
I follow him on Instagram. He's pretty funny.
Oh, I should follow him. And he's great in this. And, you know, we also meet a number of the other campers, including Clea Duvall, her name is Graham, I believe. Of course, we're also introduced to the fact that, like, all the women share a room, all the men share a room in this film's, like, very funny way of making the camp directors totally, totally blind to the reality that, like, if you have a bunch of women who are attracted to other women, maybe shoving all their beds up next to each other is not going to work. So we start to like just go through the program. The women are doing all the gender stuff indoors, like cleaning and cooking and kitchen and
babies.
Yeah. And the men are primarily doing stuff outdoors, including like fixing cars and like physical exercise.
And everything just gets just choreographed extremely sexually in yeah, a way that is really hilarious.
Yeah, they do this kind of repeated jokes, particularly with the men, that all the physical labor that they are doing is phallic in some way, shape, or form, including like the design of the outdoor space has like army men running around, and there's like one guy holding a gun, like shooting another guy who's begging, you know, not to be shot, and it just looks like a two men engaging in oral sex because it's a silhouette cutout.
With a clean mind, everything is clean, AJ.
Yeah. but yeah, and there's like a giant wrench and two nuts sticking out of the ground by like the workplace area where they're supposed to work.
And
on
when
cars.
They're playing football, they just have, you know, the weird netty crop tops that actual football players have,
yeah.
which is, I feel like, another commentary on how a lot of the macho stuff is
yeah.
you know.
Well, I remember we had a poli-sci class in high school. I don't know if you took that poli-sci class. It was a kind of poli-sci, but also kind of like philosophy and psychology as well. So we were reading a lot of just different thinkers. And we talked about Freud and the id and the ego. And I remember the professor was talking about like sex and violence being, you know, the big id thing. He goes, why do you think we love football? Because you get the violence of people clashing into each other, and then you get the sex of all the men patting each other's butts. And he didn't even like mention the cheerleaders. I thought of that with this movie.
Sexy football, sexy floor washing.
Yeah, sexy football, sexy floor washing. Everyone's really horny. Megan discovers two of the boys making out, and she gets them in trouble and becomes kind of the pariah of the group because she's...
And Rufio gets sent home.
Yeah, Rufio gets sent away. Well, sent away, we find out, because, yeah. So it's been like over a week since I've seen it. So all the middle section where we're kind of going through the steps is kind of blurring together. But pretty quickly, like, Graham and Megan start kind of forming a bond and like a slight romance. And one night they get effectively, they don't get kidnapped.
Busted out.
Yeah, they get busted out by two.
Or more just like they get picked up.
Yeah. A whole group of the students get busted out by the two former students or captives of this camp, Larry and Lloyd, who are ex-gays. And they take them to a gay bar where they all kind of party. And Graham and Megan kind of solidify their feelings for each other. And then when they get back, they all kind of sneak back. But then Mary, the house mom, discovers a matchbook from the bar and everyone gets in trouble. And so she makes them all picket, like, very, that awful church?
Westboro,
yeah,
Baptist
Westboro
Church.
Very Westboro Baptist Church. Picket Larry and Lloyd's house and, like, shout horrible things at them. But meanwhile, all through this, Graham and Megan are, like, continuing this little romance, this little, like, development of their feelings. And eventually, Mary finds out about their little love affair. And Megan is forced to leave, and she goes to Larry and Lloyd's house.
And it's, I think, fairly openly implied that she is the one to leave because Clea Duvall, like,
right,
basically says it was all her, not me, sort of thing.
Yeah, Clea Duvall has, like, the even though Clea Duvall, in the context of the movie, is, like, the one who's really encouraging Megan to like embrace her sexuality and kind of acknowledge her that she's gay and that like that's okay. There's I think it's implied that Clea Duvall is like, if she gets found out, she'll be homeless or her family will disown her or something, like something big.
No money for art school.
Yeah, so she kind of crumbles back into like I'm working so hard, I'm trying to be here.
Throws her under the straight bus.
Yeah. So Megan goes to Larry and Lloyd's house and discovers that they kind of have it's like a halfway house for kids who get kicked out or escape from this camp. Everything, whereas in the camp house, everything is pink or blue or kind of turquoisey green. In this house, everything is rainbow, like everything. And we find Rufio has been staying there. So she kind of learns to accept her sexual identity by kind of hanging out with Larry and Lloyd and learning from them. And then we get to the kind of, I don't want to call it a graduation. It's like a commencement graduation thing.
And everyone and everything is dressed in and decorated in white.
Yeah.
Because now they're pure.
Yeah. It looks like a wedding slash graduation, but yeah, very stylized
slash cult and game scene.
Yeah, so she Clea Duvall is about to graduate and Megan pulls up, they pull up in one of the trucks and she runs out and she's dressed in her cheerleader outfit and she does a cheer for Clea Duvall about how she loves her and you know, says, you know, don't graduate, come away with me. And so Clea Duvall and Megan run away. They hop in the back of the truck as the house mom is yelling after them. And they drive away, which to me, I was like, that's the end of like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's like the survivors who escape the woman who escaped is like in the back of a truck driving away.
That's a really interesting parallel.
But I was like, there's a weird like last girl thing that happens, because also at the end, like, none of the other students leave. I think we're meant to infer that like this public display of love will like liberate everyone else as well, and kind of make them realize like, I don't have to be this fake version of me.
Because that's also like there is this kind of spectrum of a feeling or reactions to being at the camp, where some of them are like, I can't wait to be straight. And yeah. It feels like that's not just like a sentence they've been taught to say. Some of them are like, I don't want to be this person. And some of them are like, this is ridiculous. Including, I love the softball player who's like, I'm straight. I just look butch. This is totally uncool, which I really, really appreciate as a detail. But, you know, like, some of them seem kind of relieved that at least they can now, again, sort of like pass as straight or be accepted as straight by their parents and have learned the codes by which to act or something.
And it is interesting too, because like, as they're going through all like the steps, like, Megan gets kicked out before finishing, and so Clea DuVall is like there to finish the last step, and it's like simulating heterosexual intercourse in these like weird skin tight leotards with leaves over their genitals with Rock, the leader's son. And it's like these like horribly, it becomes like much creepier after Megan leaves. It's like, and it is like that last step is extra creepy,
mm-hmm.
and extra icky, and like beyond the just like the mental, you know, going through just the mental gymnastics of like, yeah, I can do this.
And I think it kind of occurs to me now as we're talking about that scene specifically, it also reminds me of what many people have shared of a lot of congregations within both Mormonism and evangelical Christianity, where you have to like tell the bishop or the priest like every sinful thought you've had, if you touch yourself, how. So this idea that, like, I joked before that for the pure mind, everything is pure, but there's this idea that doing this under the guise of re-education and helping is supposed to make it not creepy, but it is so obviously creepy, you know, where you want to, you know, stop these kids and be like, your body is your body. Nobody you don't have to let anybody do anything to it that you don't want to.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. It's all, and like the question does kind of linger of like, what will happen to these kids when they leave? But then you do, in a, like a mid-credit scene, you do see Megan's family. Her parents are at a PFLAG meeting. So parents and friends.
PFLAG. I like the sound of that.
Yeah. but yeah, parents and friends of lesbian and gays, they're there to, you know, work towards accepting their daughter, which I did appreciate that little tag at the end.
So that we know that Megan is not just completely set adrift, as so many, you know, queer and trans kids are.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like, there is, I think the statistic last time I read it, at least, is that I don't remember if it's the suicide rate or the suicide attempt rate is over 40% for trans kids who don't have support at home. Yeah. And it's 4 or 5% for trans kids who do have support at home.
Yeah.
Which is like, hey, does that number tell you anything? Maybe.
And I will say this as a new parent, like, looking at this tiny baby, whatever she is going to become, and I know I'm gendering her in a way that she has no control over right now, but whatever she is going to become, or they are going to become, I could not imagine not being there and trying, you know, unless it's like, hey, I'm like totally off the deep end, I'm a murderer and I'm a psychopath, which hopefully she's not. That would be rough. But, like, I can't imagine that just because of, like, who she is or who she loves. Like, and so to me, it is still one of the, like, the fact that so many queer kids and trans kids end up homeless or, you know, destitute in that way. It makes me so angry because I'm like, but you're a bad parent. Like,
yeah, and I think it is important, again, to, when we talk about the rates of, you know, suicide, self-harm, depression in trans kids and queer kids, it's not like a hormonal or genetic thing. That's not right. what's going on. You see such huge differences. Like, that is because society is bad.
Yeah, exactly.
And because a lot of the time, primarily their family of origin is bad. Again, yeah. 40% versus 4%.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, that's not a weird coincidence. That's because
yep.
being shunned from, because it's all, a lot of the time it's not just, you know, you get kicked out. It's also like having treatment withheld, friends withheld, being told that you're wrong and dirty and going to hell and all of this stuff. And, you know, sometimes on these episodes, I try to point out and like remind the listener that I come from an A, Swedish, B, very secular point of view here.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, I've lived in the States, but like my upbringing and most of my life has been, it's so weird to realize also like I'm almost 40. So like I spent 5.5% of my life in the US, but like for an American context, which is very, very Christian.
Yep.
And also like has a very different view on how Christianity should affect, like what role that should play in people's lives and also in the lives of others, not just your family. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's difficult being queer and trans, even in, you know, perfect places. We're not perfect, like Sweden, but you know, like the secularity of our society makes a lot of things easier because your parents can think you're wrong and weird, but you probably won't have the message from them, from your extended family, from everyone around you that you're going to hell, that you're, yeah. you know, okay, this is definitely a tangent, but there's that weird idea of like, God makes no mistakes. You're supposed to be what you started at. And it's like, but it didn't God also then make me anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like,
well, I will say this. Like, I don't know if I mentioned this on this podcast before, but I was in a production of Around the World in 80 Days in December before everything shut down. We used the world's, like, the country flags to move across the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the director, when they go from Japan to San Francisco, I mean, granted, it's 1800s, right? But to indicate San Francisco, she brought out a rainbow flag. As the and we have, you know, a number of queer folks in the cast as well, and so we did a student matinee, and the students got to ask questions, and they're like, one of the students said like, hey, so I was just curious, like, why you had all the world flag, like the country flags, but then why did you do a rainbow flag when you came to America? And so one of our cast members kind of tackled that and was talking about how, like, oh, well, you know, they were landing in San Francisco, and San Francisco has historically been, you know, a kind of
haven,
a,
and a enclave.
Haven. Yeah, a haven and a center of gay rights in America. And so we wanted to kind of honor that and honor the queer folks who are in the cast, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And granted, these were elementary school kids. And after he got done with his answer, like, the whole audience burst into applause. Of all these kids, which I was like, wow, this is a very different world than we grew up in school. So there's hope. There's hope. There's hope.
And I want to also, speaking now of, you know, the situation in different parts of the U.S. primarily, I want to recommend a book called Real Queer America, LGBT Stories from Red States,
ooh.
Which I read, I think, 2 years ago, probably when it came out. And it's someone who sort of road trips through traditionally red states and talks about why actually more people are moving to red states. Like, there's this idea that blue, as in democratic, more sort of liberal states, specifically for red states, sometimes going back to their home state or hometown and sometimes leaving the cities, and how the big cities that are sort of known for being very open are losing gay bars and queer spaces. So yeah, and I think just talk, because while things have gotten exponentially better in some ways, they also have not.
Yep.
And part of that is because, you know, people become complacent, yep. and politics. Anyway, I was gonna say, like, does this movie have a main trope? And I mean, like, partly it has the most main trope of like discovering who you are and or discovering how to express your love properly, but sort of in two layers, because you have like what the movie is showing us of like people telling us explicitly, like, here's how you should act, here is how you should express love, but then the actual sort of storyline under that.
Well, and so many rom-coms and chick flicks do kind of deal with the question of, I love somebody, but I can't express it for whatever reason. And this gives a very explicit reason, right? Like, of why these characters have a hard time kind of publicly expressing their love. So it's kind of a classic trope, just couched in a very specific world.
Mm-hmm. And the main couple, I love the actors, I love the characters, I love the way their love story builds. What about you?
I do too. I think that the characters are great. I really like this movie all around. The one thing I was reading about, because I was like, oh, this is interesting. Like, there are a number of people of color as like tangential characters, right? But it still is like very white centered. And then I read Rosario Dawson was considered for Natasha Lyonne's role. And the executive producer persuaded Babbitt that because Dawson is Latina, that she would not be right for the all-American cheerleader character. Which I'm like, oh, that's...
Ooh, that's... See, that's bullshit. Part of me is kind of like, if you're going to tell a story about being queer in a Latinx family, that's not a story for white people to tell.
Yeah.
But that's a completely different reason.
Right.
And I want to recommend Brooklyn Nine-Nine for being very good about, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That whole storyline. But just being like, she wouldn't be right for the all-American cheerleader, where you're like, Mr. Yeah. Producer, exactly. Come on.
Like there are, for so much of this film's like, I mean, progressive quality is maybe kind of the wrong way to phrase it, but for so much of this film's like wonderful stuff that has going on for it, you do feel like little moments of studio or producer kind of like input that's like, ugh, like dial this back, fix this.
Like the Graham character could definitely have been a person of color because you wouldn't be telling their story in the same sort of main character point of view way. But I know that Clea DuVall had been in Babbitt, the director's short film, and like she really, really wanted her for that part.
But
it's so hard to, because you're like the side characters of color, that isn't part of their story, which is such a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, you're like, yes, good. Let's not make this only about how whatever racially coded characters, like the stereotypes there, but then also like, okay, but that is an important thing to bring up. I don't know.
Cultural
like,
specificity is a thing.
It's really hard to say. In general, how do you feel about the side characters? Because I think so many of them are just so amazing, so well written, so good.
I really like Lloyd and Larry. I think they have like a really real relationship that is like, they don't have a lot of screen time, but there's a patter and a familiarity.
Loving sniping.
Yeah, which I think is so delightful. I really like all the students. And I do, you know, the adults effectively are caricatures, and they're supposed to be. I think, I think Mary is wonderfully evil with just a little hint of like cluelessness. And in my mind, I also read her as like also maybe gay.
She's definitely, you know, she thinks that she's fixed Rock, who is her son,
right?
Clearly.
Yeah.
And again, you get a lot of the things of like what the thing, you know, macho man. But like, you know, like a lot of things that are coded as very male can also be coded as very gay. And that has, you know, all of these things have a lot of implications. And like, you also have like femme lesbians, butch, lipstick, chapstick, whatever. But yeah, like I think she could be read as maybe also queer. She could be read as just like on the edge, on the verge.
Yeah.
You know?
And RuPaul is great. a little, I think RuPaul's a little underutilized. I think he's very funny and doesn't get, like, because they kind of butch that character up so much, doesn't get as many chances to really shine and be as funny as I think we all know RuPaul is, but still, you know, is still fun in that role.
Yeah. And I mean, so that kind of covers the villains and antagonists, the parents, again, Mick Stoll is funny. It's, do you have a favorite character?
I really want it to be Megan, but, mm-hmm. and I think Natasha Lyonne does a great job. I just feel like she is also a bit of a cipher. Like she's intentionally,
I was going to use the exact same word.
Yeah. And so it's either like the combo Lloyd and Larry, or it's Clea DeVol.
Mm-hmm. I really like, Hillary, Melanie Lynskey, the Australian actress.
Oh yeah.
Who was in Heavenly Creatures and
when she,
yeah,
shows up.
Who's, yeah, her GUIDE to the other side.
Yeah.
And who just has this very sort of chipper demeanor that you can't figure out if it's a put on or not. I really like her. I mean, I really like Melanie Lynskey, the actor too. So that might play in.
Yeah. She's great.
Do you have a least favorite?
I don't really have like a least favorite character. I do think the one character that is kind, I wish we learned more about or kind of got more from is actually Rock.
Yeah.
I do feel like
you want to know, did he go through the camp or is she completely clueless?
Yeah, exactly. Like, is he her son that she just believes is straight, or was he the first like test subject in this camp? Mm-hmm. I just feel like they use him as a chance for some, you know, jokes about real men don't use straws and some like, you know, isn't it funny that this guy who's supposed to be straight is gay, is clearly gay jokes. But yeah, I think anyone else who would become my least favorite character, like anybody at her school or things like that, you just don't spend enough time with them. Like Michelle Williams is in it in a pretty small role, but you just don't spend enough time with them to like get that they are like full blown bullies or if they're just like also brainwashed by this conservative town or whatever it is. What about you?
No, same, basically. It's just like, you know, it's that situation of anyone you dislike, you're meant to. So it's not like, mm-hmm. you want to remove them or like you hate that they're in the movie, kind of.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite part? Because for me, it's when they touch Pinky Fingers.
That is really... Is that and like when she's like stroking the
and like stroking the top of her arm, where you get that like there's so little... Which is also... Because like, again, they share a dormitory.
Right.
All of them. So like there's, you know, but this like that sense of like, I think maybe I feel something for this person. I wonder if they maybe feel something. It's just those little moments. And also because they are so real and natural and outside the stylized bubble.
Mm-hmm.
So they have like even more of an impact.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. I like that. That is a nice, there are a handful of moments in this movie that are like kind of do fall outside of that hyper-stylization that feel really, really lovely. I think that, like, for me, the... I didn't really have a favorite moment, but I loved the design. Like, the design of the film is so fun, and, like, I looked up the art director for this film, and, like, she's done nothing else as cool and fun and funky, and this was one of her first projects, so it was, like, clearly, like, hey, you have a cool aesthetic, go for it. Let's go wild.
Yeah, and I love how, you know, it's not just like this room is painted blue and the things in it are blue. It's like they've done a sort of Mr. Bean paint explosion.
Yeah.
Just like everything has been spray painted at one time.
Well, and
kind of deal.
And alternately, like when they're showing like early in the film, they're like showing slideshows of like happy heterosexual couple life. And it's mm-hmm. like cutouts from magazines. So there's this idea that like, yes, this world of, like, the world of heterosexual happiness is a construct. Like, in the context of this movie, and it's all fake. And I dug that. Like, where everything is plastic and fake and monochrome and, yeah.
Because it's going through the motions is all that matters, you know?
Yeah.
Just, like you said, turn it off, push it down. I really appreciate that it's not like, oh, everyone escapes, because like there are the layers there of like some people maybe wanted to be quote unquote saved.
Cured,
because it's easier, because like they have internalized all that stuff, or they just want to get their parents off their backs and get to like go to school or whatever. And like you said, also that that Megan's parents are shown to start to be supportive, so that you get like not just the momentary happy end, but the more of a sort of happy end, knowing that, you know, she gets to have some sort of family life.
So really quickly, before we get into the ratings, I do want to just bring up a question. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it, but like, as somebody who researches and writes and studies comedy and specifically satire, like, I acknowledge that this film is a satirization of not just like gay conversion camps and rehab programs in that way, but also like a critique and satire against straight America. My question is always with satire is like, satire as comedy is a weapon. Like it's weaponized humor, and the target should usually be someone in power. And it is, right? In this movie, it's straight America, which, it, you know, tends to hold sway. But I'm also like, occasionally with satire, and this is my problem with The Daily Show, which is satire against right wing, particularly it used to be Fox News, but now it's kind of like right wing in general. But it's like, who's watching it?
Yeah.
Right? And are they going to get the message of this? And this movie does feel at times like it's really by and for, you know, queer and queer supporting communities. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it's like the people who need to see this.
This is not Love, Simon, basically.
Yeah. Well, and it's like the people who need to see this, who need to like have their priorities checked, won't see it. Or you know what I mean? So, like,
and even if they start watching it, won't finish it because
they
feel offended.
This is my this is my whole hang up with satire in general. Is it's like it's hard.
Well, yeah, like because there are, I think, also sort of two flavors of satire: the one that causes people to think differently, and the one that's like, you know, going to a stand up show where they're like, hey, have you ever considered how girls always go to the bathroom two at a time? And you're like, hey, I've recognized that. That's funny. That's me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And except, you know, actually funny, where like it's that satire where you're like, there's just the sort of recognition and the pleasure of, which then is like
collective laughing at your oppressor.
Yeah. And I think maybe it's, does it make sense if I'm like, it's satirical, but not necessarily full on satire.
I totally get that.
Like it's a satirically flavored narrative, a satirically either, you know, an aesthetic or verbal jokes or whatever. But maybe it's not full on satire because it's not.
It's not, satire aims to like change, to like affect change. I don't think this movie is like aiming to affect change, more to like report on and. Maybe it's even like it's depowering if you're part of the queer community or queer supporting community and you see this and you like are afraid of gay conversion therapy or something, like maybe this like robs that of some of its power. Maybe that's where this movie is.
It sort of punctures the
yeah
because I mean satire is can also be not even about necessarily like changing minds but through like pointing out how silly something is,
making it less
monstrous. Yeah, just being like, hey, have you considered how, because, you know, laughter does rob power of power sometimes. Yeah. If you can, you know, if you're afraid and you're taking something very, very seriously, but then you laugh at it, that fear disappears.
Yeah.
And also, as we've learned in Monsters, Inc., laughter is much more powerful than fear. no, but you know what I mean? So I think there's that as well. And like, for instance, like I said at the beginning, you know, you can definitely see the sort of the John Waters feel of this.
Oh,
and John Waters is, you know, also kind of his own flavor of satire, where it's like, could you necessarily always pinpoint what he's satirizing?
No, not always.
And will the people in power or the people that he is poking fun at watch it? Maybe not.
Yeah.
And will you at the end feel like you're satisfied as someone who's also against? So like, you know, there's that point of satire that's maybe just like, even like on the level of sort of Dadaism, where just like everything is absurd.
Yeah.
Nothing is important. Nothing is, you know, higher or more important than anything else, which I think also has its it's time and place.
Yeah.
I know. I see what you're saying. And that's actually one of the criticisms in a lot of the reviews, like at CNN, the critic said that But I'm a Cheerleader is a smug little comedy that tries to mock other people's self-righteousness while ignoring its own, which is where I'm like, what's like the self-righteousness of, it's not like queer people are better than everyone else. It's more like, hey, queer people are also people. And yeah, exactly. Like queer people are also people and you are mean for being mean about us. And I don't know my favorite, in The Guardian, Peter Bradshaw wrote, I would have preferred to know more in documentary terms about the actual reality of these terrible camps rather than sit through this heavy-handed and oddly lenient comedy. I remember when I was maybe even in high school, but when I was going into university, because my mom's a literature professor, and she was like, You should never in papers or reviews talk about the book or movie that you wish it was.
Yes.
Which is partly what we do on the show, but, you know, not only where it's like you have to talk about what's there and like the problems with it and the strengths with it. And here it's like almost a parody of like, I want a documentary about the real situation in this camps. And it's like, that's
not
none of what this movie is at all.
It's not trying to give you reality.
And those documentaries and books exist, and yes, it's very good and important that they exist, but that's just such a weird, that's a weird criticism.
And I do appreciate that there is trauma in this movie, right? This movie mm-hmm. is about a traumatic thing that these kids are going through. I do like that it is not necessarily a trauma narrative, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, because not every minority representation film needs to be about how trauma strengthens the spirit, right? There's a goofiness, there's a winkingness, there's a knowing in-joke quality to this movie that I think is valuable.
And also, I think sometimes, and I think we've talked about this briefly before, like, we sometimes want, like, specialness from minority stories.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it has to be super meaningful and it has to be kind of innovative. And part of me is like, yeah, but there is a point where a teenager has not. Yeah, but also there is a point in a teenager's life where they haven't seen a movie like this yet.
Yeah.
You know? And maybe they don't want to watch something from the 80s or 70s or even something from 93, you know?
Yeah.
Where it's like, this meant something to me. And I've seen tons of better things since and worse things since, both as like a queer teenager, a queer young adult, whatever. But then, there's so many layers here. But
yes.
Sometimes it's also just nice to be like, this is for me, only me. Nobody else will like it. You know, this is for me and my in-group.
Yeah.
And we don't get to see a lot of that always. So on Rotten Tomatoes, this has a 41% fresh rating from critics and a 74% fresh rating from audiences. It has a 6.7 on IMDb. And I think this is definitely a case where this has a niche audience that loves it a lot.
Yeah.
Even with its problems. And the critics are like talking about basically like, you know, at best, they're like, this is a good movie with a good cast, but it's thin or whatever, which again, I both agree with and not. What would you give this out of 10 Natasha Lyonnes?
I mean, like, I don't know. To me, this movie feels like a 6 seems low. I'm going to say 7
mm-hmm.
because, like, I appreciate what it's doing. It does feel a little heavy-handed and, like, a little, like, yes, we know this. Like, some of the jokes are a little, like, but I also recognize that there is some innovation here in this movie, and I love the design.
And also, as you pointed out pretty early on, we also don't know what this script was like before it came
exactly
into like executive producers and studio hands. Like it might have been sharper. We don't know.
Yeah. I think to me, like all the jokes about like the straight people in this movie and the gay conversion camp are pretty familiar. Like, you know, they're not recognizing the homosexuality that's happening right under their noses. And I just wanted something a little more surprising from this, mm-hmm. you know,
like, even though just a little more insightful sort of.
Yeah. Like I love the camp quality. I love the design. I wouldn't want to lose any of that, but I just wanted a little bit more. And maybe had I seen this in the 90s, it would have felt really like, in the late 90s, it would have felt really like groundbreaking. I just think seeing it 20 years later, it's a little, we've seen a lot of this stuff done really well now, and I'm missing that. I don't have the time period context to go with this. So I'm going to say 7.
I'm actually pretty much the same, but for slightly different reasons, where like, I could maybe give it an 8, but I do also see that like it has its flaws, but I do think it has a lot of strengths. I could give it, you know, a super strong 7 or a slightly like an 8-, you know, because it does have a lot of things, and even the flaws do make it kind of charming.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah. There's an amateur quality to this, which is really like fun and campy and charming.
Yeah. And that's kind of where like my fix is also, because like there is stuff to be fixed in this movie, and some of it, again, we don't know what of that was in the script and what happened later. Because my main thing, like, is I don't want this to be a hardcore documentary, but like I feel the whole movie needs to go a little bit harder.
Yeah.
My main thing is that Kathy Moriarty, the house mom, as you put it, she needs to lean more into either full-on cartoonish evil, like you were saying, like Umbridge levels.
Yes.
Or she needs to be like sweet beyond belief, where she is, where it's like unpleasantly pleasant.
Yeah.
Because she is, you know, kind of harsh, and she becomes impatient right away. And I feel like that she needs to get annoyed later into the movie, like either right away and go full Cruella de Vil, or she needs to be very sweet and slowly become more frustrated and be like that sort of super scary sweet that is a lot scarier and more dangerous, where it's someone who just is so certain that they are right and, you know, everything is perfectly and lovely and you can push all your feelings away. So that's like my main fix. And then I had what I first was like weirder, and then I was like, that's not weirder, that's also a fix, because I was like, what if the camp becomes a camp for trans people of all ages, to be like, you get makeup coaching, which is something that if regardless of the age, but even more so for people who transition later in life, if you're a trans woman, to both learn about makeup in general, but also learn like, how do you conceal like 5 o'clock shadow if you're not on hormone replacement or it's not working on your beard or whatever? Like these things, and like teaching people about binder safety or the different kinds of packers. And like, I just, cause if you already have all this like hyper gender stuff, and if you feel like you want some of that super binary, super gendered knowledge as you're transitioning, which not everyone does or needs, I just thought that would be like just really funny to be like, what are the actual best parts of this? Yeah. And for that matter, I mean, like, send dads to be in to learn to change diapers. Yeah. So that's like my weirdness fix, kind of. What about you? How would you fix this?
My fix is similar. I would love to, and I didn't even think about this, but I think, yeah, the character of Mary needs more in one or either direction. That would help a lot. I think also one of my fixes is throw a lot more money at this movie for the design, because there is a quality of the design, which I love the design. It does also feel like a little feels like they needed more money. Like
you paint all the same like sets over and over and over again.
Yeah. There's a weird part where like, I think they have like these, they're wearing these dresses or something. I think it's when they're like scrubbing the kitchen floor. And you can see like the threads hanging off of, one of their dresses. And it's like, clearly the costume designer just hadn't the time or the resources to like just sew a hem in. And so it's like little things like that.
Or they need to be more obvious about the fact that like a ton of kids have already worn this dress. It's not your size. It's right. Not.
Like it so, just looked like cut fabric to me. Like we just cut this fabric and made this really quick. And so to me, it's like, if you throw a lot more money at this movie and like get a bigger team behind this artistic vision and really ramp it up so that it goes even bigger. I know this movie is very stylized, but I would love to see it go bigger. And I would even love to see like what this movie, and my kind of fix/make it weird, is like set it in the 50s, but go, because there's a lot of that 50s retro mid-century aesthetic. And of course, like the 50s housewife model is crops up throughout this whole movie, but like set it back then and see what this movie looks like when you just hyper stylize something in the 50s so that it's not retro, but it's like the contemporary time. I would love to see what like that version of this movie is as well.
I think it would also be really interesting to set it today, like push it the other
push
way.
It forward, push it forward.
Because what's so, you know, fascinating and very sad is that, yes, society has come a long way, but these camps still exist. And these camps still, you know, kill people directly or indirectly.
Yeah.
What did we learn from this movie?
I learned that Rufio did another movie.
Yeah, Dante Basco on Instagram. We'll link him in the show notes. I learned that it makes me happy when teenage me's favorite movies can still hit somewhere.
Yeah, still hold up
in my pineal gland or whichever one controls emotion. Next week we will be talking about The Lake House. You can find our show notes at theincomparable.com/chickflickfix. You can support us on Patreon if you want, patreon.com/chickflickfix. We are chickflickfix on Twitter and Instagram. You can give us a ping. We'll be back next week. Say goodbye, AJ.
Goodbye, AJ.